Ladies, gentlemen, thank you for joining us here in the second hour. Welcome back. We're talking with Tan Staffel from the Age of Treason, or Age of Treason. And we have much more to discuss, many more things I want to ask you about, you know, both what's happening in America now with Ann Coulter's comment and what you believe about the Donald and Trump and all these kinds of issues. So much more to discuss there. But let me ask you a bit more about the question of origins, of differences, of the reality of race and all these kinds of things. There is, as you rightly pointed out before, many new discoveries to come out regularly. And they're always spun in kind of a certain way. I didn't keep up that much yet. Unfortunately, I didn't have time of the new discovery in South Africa of Homo naledi, I think they call it, if that's the correct term. What can you tell us about this find and what is that indicative of? I know that they wrote about that this was allegedly they've been buried in a kind of a chamber, which kind of emphasized the point that this might have been a religious kind of rite to a certain extent, which takes us kind of closer to what we associate with modern humans. But how did they spin this one, and what can you actually tell us about the find?
Right. My understanding of it comes from two things. That article I forwarded you ahead of time about who we are, or who are we, is the subtitle of it. But it was that Daily Beast article, The Ugly Nationalist Politics of Human Origins. And I really see that as just more of the same of what we've had since Franz Boas, is this spin, as you say, the narrative, our understanding of what this means, and the facts that you stated are pretty much my understanding too. That this is humans or hominids from the about 1 million to 2 million years ago. That's how old these bones are, and that the astounding thing about it is that they seem to have been very deliberately placed in the back of a very hard to get to part of a cave. It's not like in the back of an open cave, you just walk to the back and drop the bones off. There were places where you have to squeeze through, that it's not clear how they did that. But then again, there are the cave paintings in Europe from 40,000 years ago, similar situation, very deep caves. Yeah. It takes a long time to get into the spot where the cave paintings are found. You wonder, how did prehistoric man ever do this? But as you say, the indication is that if they took care with the bodies, that is a culturally significant thing, that it shows some sort of a religious, or the beginnings of a religious or a self-awareness consciousness. And this is, again, 1 million years ago. It's in the gap between Australopithecus and Homo, which are these, there's a sort of broken line there that they don't understand how exactly it's connected. And that's the importance. And a lot of this information, by the way, is based on a Nova episode that just came out. I'm about halfway through watching, which actually has a lot more details. It also has a bit of political spin to it that you have to be conscious of and understand. Yeah. There's more facts there. It sort of fleshes out the details of the research, shows you how they discovered it and the significance of it. And that's where I'm getting this understanding that it's in the gap, this new discovery between Homo and Australopithecus, which is kind of the way they describe it is Australopithecus is like this very ape-like thing, and the record of that peters out at something like 2 million years ago. Lucy is the most prominent example of that, if you've heard of the hominid.
Oh, yeah.
And all of these are called hominids, you know, basically the forerunners of man, somewhere in our family tree back into the past. And then Homo erectus is the first of the Homo, and then from there it progresses on till you finally get to Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, humans, modern humans, and our wonderful diversity of today.
And there is a kind of a gap there still. I mean, they are looking, yes. They're trying to piece it together, the missing link, whatever you want to call it, And there's been so much back and forth in this, and to be honest, I don't trust much of the genetics. The interpretation that they give us of it, rather, and because, you know, you can do a swab and send it to one of these companies, and I've heard from other people that say that, you know, you should do multiple of them. You can't just trust the one. Some samples are probably contaminated. It's not very well done. It's interpretation. But I mean, I remember watching this show way back. I think it was probably Natural Geographics or something like that, Discovery Channel maybe, and they were talking about this, it was a few years ago now, this new exciting development that we can determine where you're from, you know, and they just you know, swabbed a person. They were running around in mall asking people to swab them, and then they, you know, came back with the results and contacted them later, and it was like, oh, we can see here that, you know, you come from Africa, you know? And and then this dude, the next person was like, oh, you come from Africa. I was like, oh, how exciting, you know? So what can you say about this? Like, we're all the same, the out of Africa thesis that really was launched, you know?
Yeah, that's the irony of this ugly nationalist politics of human origins article, is that it's talking about how, you know, the evil scientific racists from 100 years ago were politicizing science, when the reality is science has been politicized since then, mainly for Jewish interests, to promote Jewish interests. And that's the driving force behind it. And the article itself is promoting this book by Jonathan Marks, who is talking about this. He calls it biopolitics, how, you know, basically it's agenda-driven science, and that it's done by narrative, and which is what the Jews are doing today. And, you know, the narrative that they're pushing is, you know, we're all immigrants, and the anthropological narrative is we're all Africans. And this, what they don't mention is that this out of Africa theory is a relatively recent post-World War II consensus that is still controversial. There's still disagreement with it. And the article itself mentions how up until 1962, you know, the scientific racists thought that the races had developed separately, and how stupid that is that they thought that, you know, I'm paraphrasing it, but, and that's the intimation that they're giving it. We're the voice of science. This is how the fraud works, is they take on the mantle of science because everyone recognizes the value of an objective testimony as to what the reality is, right? That's why science has authority with most people, because it is supposedly objective. But the fraud is that they say that they're arguing on the basis of science and in the interests of objectivity, but the reality is that they're arguing an ethnic agenda that's good for them. And that it's false. It's a false argument that's being made. It's a fraudulent argument. And this goes all the way back to Boas. It's really just the modern equivalent of it. Carlton Kuhn, who they don't refer to by name, is the race scientist that they are talking about. He is probably the last great white man who was doing race science. And as I've already described, he was, I think, in earnest, trying to really understand what the record, as far as he could piece it together. There was a little bit of narrative in there. There has to be, when you have a disconnected, when you just have points and you're trying to connect the dots to figure out what the picture is, you are forced to sort of fill in the blanks, and narrative is part of how you do that. Even some of what I'm saying, or you could say all of what I'm saying, is just my narrative. But so, you know, narrative itself is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that you can see that there are good narratives and there's bad narratives. There's your enemy's narrative, which dominates now, and there's the white man's narrative, which I think, in fairness, trying to speak objectively now, was actually an objective understanding of the facts that they had available at the time. As late as 1962, it seems like, you know, most of what I've read of what Carlton Kuhn had to write still has not been contradicted by the most recent discoveries. If anything, it's been actually validated by many of the more recent discoveries.
Interesting.
And truth doesn't fear examination anyway.
Exactly. I mean,
there's nothing that they can find in any cave in Africa or anywhere else that I would be afraid for them to find. My sympathy with my people does not hinge on, you know, where we came from originally. I mean, I actually think Darwin had it right, that and the DNA that's been discovered since then pretty much demonstrates that we are connected to every other form of life on this planet at some point in the distant past. You know, sea slugs, we're related to genetically. Yeah, if you go far enough back, we have a common ancestor. It's just that it goes so far back that it's difficult to imagine. I mean, we have trouble imagining back to the beginning of our own lives. We're talking about geologic periods of scales of time here. You know, a million years ago, it's so long that a skull that's fallen to the ground has had stone form around it. And that's, you know, if you want to get a grasp on how long ago a million years is, that's how long it is that stone can form.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if out of Africa, you know, it is true or turns out to be true, whatever, then, you know, then the evils of colonialism wasn't that. It was just simply us returning back to the motherland and using the resources that that was belonged to us, right? So
yes, but that's another trick of the morality of the argument in North America. The supposed wrong that was done is when Europeans came here and stole this land from the first peoples, the Native American, the indigenous peoples.
I mean, the Salutrians, and, yeah.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's one of the things, the Ice Age, Columbus, Salutrians, you know, we can say, no, we were the first ones here. It really doesn't matter. Ultimately, the land belongs to whoever will fight for it.
Of course.
I'm just pointing to the moral fraud that's committed in pointing at Americans and white Americans and saying, your ancestors stole this land from the Indians. So that's why it's okay for the Mexicans to be moving here and taking it back from you. They're just, you know, the descendants of the Indians. You didn't genocide. And you can see the moral fraud because in Europe, the same thing doesn't apply. There, the supposed rights of the indigenous to live in their ancestral lands without being molested is not even a consideration. It's
exactly.
Europeans don't have any right to Europe, even though they are literally the descendants of the people who settled that continent when the ice receded from it. They were the very first people to inhabit it.
It's not about the colonization or recolonization. It's ultimately about who is doing it. And in this case, then, if it's Europeans going to America, that's the wrong people.
It's who whom, as Lenin put it. Yeah. Who whom is what's really critical, what's really important. All politics is really biopolitics. It's really biological and based. It's race-driven.
And we most of us as whites, we don't get that yet. We don't. I mean, there's no. I never thought this way before. These were subjects that was brought to me. It was like it was forced upon me when I realized that there was differences between me and my friends and the immigrants who were coming into Sweden. There was a behavioral and cultural difference, and it was a rude awakening. And I think that this is how it is for most people. We still walk around and think that everyone thinks like we do, and somehow. That people don't think about race, and it's like white people don't think about race, but everyone else seems to be doing that, you know?
Yeah, we don't, but there's two parts to it. The psychologists have identified what they call the implicit and the explicit. The implicit being the sort of what we would call instincts, you know, the little sense that you get, the little voice in your head that tells you that whether you're comfortable because you're surrounded by people that look like you and act like you and think like you, or the uncomfort you get when you're surrounded. The alienation you feel when you're surrounded by aliens. And that's all implicit psychology. It's inborn. It's stuff that the current race science type articles that you see coming out of the Jews media is focused on overcoming even that instinctive tendency toward racial awareness. And then there's the explicit racial awareness, which, as I said, 100 years ago was probably at its peak with books being published and selling. They were bestsellers at the time. Madison Grant wrote one, The Passing of the Great Race, which is usually cited as one of the examples of this genre of, and this reflects this understanding, this racial consciousness of who we are and what not only our differences are, but where they come from and what our similarities are, what our links are. If you go far enough back in European history before nations, Europeans were relatively homogenous. If you go 40,000 years back to Cro-Magnon, it was, you know, I'm sure that there were cultural differences in the various reaches, but biologically it was a thinly populated and yet remarkably homogenous society, more homogenous than today.
Yeah, I mean, the alienation that you mentioned, I mean, that's understandable. And I think that's why people who come to Europe from outside of Europe feel this alienation in our countries. And that's why they lobby to get more people like them on the television and in the media. They want to have their own people on boards of the major companies that we founded. They want to have their people as professional politicians running the business inside of our countries. And that's why they're seeking the transformation of everything that they know to make it look like it's them who's there and that we're running, and that would make them feel comfortable. But obviously the solution to that is not to transform European countries into something which they are not, but simply let these people be among their own people so that these feelings of alienation, or I don't know what it is that really is going on, that the psychological mechanism, maybe there's some kind of problem they have with inferiority complexes or something. I mean, who knows? But the fact is, these are all, you know, manufactured problems that shouldn't be something that we should spend our time trying to resolve.
Yes, the differences are exacerbated. The propaganda from the media exacerbates the these racial differences in racial consciousness and encourages racial consciousness amongst non-whites, encourages them to be proud and also to be to think of themselves as victims of whites. That's what identity politics is all about. And it encourages at the same time whites to feel guilty and to think, you know, they don't want to be white. Even if there was such a thing as white, they don't want to be white because there's nothing but negative attached to being white. And so that's what it's all really an attempt to tear down our defenses, what really works. And you can see that in the invasion of Europe, how the contrast with Israel, where Israel just says, no, we can't take them because it would destroy us. But, you know, Europe is just expected to destroy itself. It's to take in so many people that Europe is destroyed. And of course, it's not, Europe isn't destroying itself. The people of Europe don't want this invasion. They don't want to be changed. It's really a top-down financed thing. It's coming from the very wealthiest and very the most powerful people and the traders who go along with them for their own personal gain, who sell out their own people.
You know, Barbara Spector, whom we all whom our people know very well, attributing to the quotes of making you know, forcing multiculturalism upon Europe and that the Jews are going to be responsible for that. That clip has made it around the world, but she's been quite active on Twitter. And I think a couple of months ago, actually, but late last year, she tweeted "end white people" as one of her tweets. And she got in a tremendous amount of flack for this. Of course, people confronted and then she tried to backpedal. But kind of in this whole conversation, people started to asking her now with the immigration issue and say, when is Israel going to open its gates, you know, to refugees? And what are you doing? And her answer was that Israel is a tiny nation with only 8 million people.
Right.
And it was like, wait a minute, you're in a country lobbying for the destruction, not only of Europe, but specifically that country. You're getting taxpayers' money. We are, in other words, in Sweden. She's in Sweden, for those who don't know. She's in Sweden lobbying for the destruction of Sweden with our money against us in a country that basically has about 8 million Swedish people. I mean, the other 1.5 million are basically immigrants now. But this is the myopic, just blinding kind of ethnocentrism that these people have, you know?
Yeah, it's just that. It's an example of that chutzpah, that arrogance to be sitting in a country of 8 million people and tell them that they've got to take complete aliens that will destroy them. And actually, you know, I would point out about Barbara Spector's sales pitch there is she's using the Boasian thing that you know, this is what, she argues that it's a good thing, and this is a pattern throughout the op-eds in support of this refugee crisis that Europe has to take these people, is that it's a good thing for Europe. It's going to enrich Europe. It's going to be it's morally right to do. It'll make you feel good to agree with it, but also in the end, it's going to make us all rich too. And that's the basic argument that's been used in the United States as well for letting in, you know, millions of Mexican peasants. But it doesn't make sense. All you just think about it for 2 seconds and you can see Barbara Spector's, in her case, it was, you know, in order to survive, Europe has to go through this multicultural transformation and basically become not Europe. She doesn't draw it out that way. She describes it as if it's something wonderful. She talks about Europe, by the way, collectively as Europe. You know, not, yep. She doesn't talk about it as Europeans. And you see this over and over again in the Jewish narrative that describing, you know, oh, woe is the Jews. Europe has mistreated us for 2 millennia. They talk about Europe, and even white people tend to do this too, as an abstract thing, as the name Europe, instead of saying Europeans and humanizing what's at stake, that it's actually living, breathing people that are going to, and that's where, how you can see through the fraud that Barbara Spector is, it's already pretty transparent. I think most people who hear her talk realize what's going on. It's like Noel Ignatieff, however you pronounce his name, where he wants to deconstruct whiteness. And it's obvious that he's just playing word games with basically killing the white race, ending the white race as a race, as a people. But he's dehumanized it into this concept of whiteness, and then that's the fraud that he's selling, is that he's just going to be discontinuing and deconstructing this abstract thing called whiteness that isn't real. So of course we can just take it apart and put it into it. But all you have to do is substitute Jewishness for whiteness, and you can see how aggressive that is. And how Jews would instinctively attack anybody who would propose such a thing, that Jewishness be deconstructed, because they realize that's the basis. You have to have a consciousness of your identity as a people if you want to continue as a people. It's, you know, the interplay of genes and memes is very interesting to me, that where I see that the tendencies of peoples are baked into their genes. I recognize also that the memes, the ideas, have in the short term more power. And that's how this can be done to us, how this can be our gene pool, our line can be ended because of these poisonous ideas that we entertain in our heads, these fantasies that are actually leading us off a cliff. And that's a good metaphor for it, is that if you can talk somebody into walking off a cliff, you end their line permanently. And as a race, that's what's being done to us.
Well, and that's the other thing here that people don't think about specifically, I would say, young women that are usually targeted for the propaganda in the media of race mixing and you know, blending themselves out and having race mixed babies, because that's the popular thing to do. That's the cool thing to do. That's the trendy thing to do. I don't think that they are aware of the fact that this effectively everything that has gone before them, everything that has made them them, is going to be terminated at that stage, and they are going to end their parents and their grandparents' line with them. And this aspect is also, of course, emphasized by the fact that most people who are mixed, they never recognize themselves as being part. I mean, look at Obama, for example. I mean, who thinks of him as half white? No one does, you know. So it goes back to that, you know, identification that you said before. They side against the whites because that's also the trendy thing to do. It would feel bad to do that. In fact, I think in some cases they can be more vehemently hateful of whites than any other, because it's almost like it's a part that they know that they have inside of themselves, and therefore they resent it more almost, or something. It's kind of bizarre, isn't it?
Yes, it is resentment, that the person of mixed race, the psychology there seems to be that they resent the white half more than they resent the other half, whatever it is. And I see that even with the mix between whites and Jews, Europeans and Jews, is that Jews are actually more exclusive and more openly exclusive and will push them away. But they don't get upset with the Jews for keeping them out. They go and take their resentment out on whites for being, you know, concerned about the purity of their race or whatever. And really, that's the exception when it comes to whites. Whereas it's the rule with Jews, this concern for racial purity and continuation. I mean, it's one of the instructive things of listening to what the Jews themselves have to say about their own peoplehood and their own continuity, is that they are obsessed about this, exactly the way you put it, that this heritage as a Jew means you have, going off into the dim past, one parent and ancestor after another marrying other Jews, and here you are, you're going to give it all away by marrying out of the tribe and marrying some non-Jew, and your children won't be Jews. And, you know, if you just swap the words white and Jew there, you would be listening in on some horribly racist conversation.
Exactly.
Which, because it's Jews, it's not racist. And that's, you know, a point I've tried to make about that language is how whites interpret the idea of racism in an objective fashion, that it's something that any race mistreating any other race is racism. But empirically, you see in the way that the word is actually deployed and weaponized, it's as a weapon against whites. It's racist equals white. It's talking about psychopathologizing something that white people are doing to preserve themselves and without even having to do anything negative to anyone else, just finding another white person and getting married to them. We're getting to the point in America now where you can find these op-eds and articles encouraging white people to not even do that. You know, that's
racist.
Yeah. Racist. That's white privilege. That's something you shouldn't do. You should, as you say, that they're aiming at young women and trying to encourage them to find, and young men as well, to find the most alien, different person in order to improve diversity somehow.
Do the shard on that. It would basically mean that all you would see is just like, well, that's what we know, that diversity means no white people. That's what it means, because that's what it would result in. And, you know, again, yes. I mean, at least for me, I don't have a personal problem with those who choose to have a marry with someone else, that people fall in love. We've talked about this in the past before too. And I know several that have done this, and it's nothing, you know, personal against them, or that I hate them, or you know, anything like that. This is about, what I'm talking about is the concerted effort by the media as a strategy to exterminate white people, that are specifically targeting young people by making it hip and cool, and that this is the thing you should do. We even have you know, feminist social justice warriors now that are talking about the fact that if you don't have, you know, sex with a black guy, you're racist. You know, it's like these absurd right. things that are starting to pop out, and that's really what I'm against, this idea that it's management, it's social engineering at the height of it, and it's also then a ruthless racist ideology behind this against white people.
Yes, it's a racial animus against whites that would be okay with making this kind of propaganda. And it's more than just race mixing. It's encouraging, with basic feminism, it's encouraging girls to put off childbearing until their eggs are too old. And you know, it's just a biological fact that if a woman is going to have children, she needs to have them when she's young and not wait until she's old. But feminism has convinced millions of women to never have a child. And if they do get pregnant, they get an abortion. Queer marriage and the queer lifestyle is another example of the more people, more of your enemy you can convince to go off and have some sort of dead-end relationship with someone of the same sex, the better, because then they won't be producing the next generation of enemy. It's all sorts of degeneracy is being encouraged by the Jewish media. And I call it the Jewish media because that's really, to a first approximation, who sets the tone of, and who can certainly nix anything that they don't like. If they see something being said that they don't like, they can, you know, by power of veto, silence it. So the yeah. only thing that gets into the media is things that Jews approve of.
Yeah, it's true. They use all of these things politically as a political strategy. And you know, you mentioned Noel Ignatieff, of course, and the immense hatred and racism that's behind that, and the very fact, just as you say, that they get away with it as well, that nothing happens, that no one says anything. Again, indicative of the fact that whites don't think about race. They don't care about that, it seems like. Very few are speaking up about this, and but they get away with it. But he's not the only example. We know Barbara Spector, but recently we had Gregory Gysi in Germany talking about how great it is the Germans are not having babies because they're all Nazis and they need to go anyway. Irvin Kuhn in Norway, who said that Norway is too white and they haven't learned how to be, you know, non-racists yet, etc. I mean, even the very founder of the pan-European movement, Kudnov Kalergi, talked about this too, quite openly as a plan to change the very racial makeup of Europe and turn it into the Eurasian Negroid race, as he said, you know, quote from his book.
Like himself, he was a product of race mixing, and Gysi in Germany has some Jewish ancestor, a grandparent or something, and Kuhn, just from that last name, I would guess, has some sort of Jewish background as well. And this is a hump that a lot of white people have trouble getting over. Even when they think of race, they think of in terms of black and white, the most extreme contrast in race. What they don't get is that the Jews are distinct enough to be understood in terms of race as well, and that the mixture between Jew and not Jew, and Jew and European even, is a racial mixture. Jews are Caucasian biologically, Caucasian being a sort of very loose term for whiteness. If you're looking at the continental scale race, you could consider Jews white in that kind of a classification categorization. But the reality is that when it comes to their minds, it comes to their identity, and actually even when it comes to their genes, they're distinctive genetically, and you can see that in their DNA. But certainly in their minds, the story that they tell themselves, teach their children, is that white people are the enemy. They are, you know, have been out to destroy the Jews for as long as the Jews can remember. The reality is that the Jews have been encroaching upon whites and infiltrating and manipulating and exploiting whites for as long as history goes back.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, it's just worth pointing out again and again, these quotes we brought up lately quite a bit in the program, but it's just, I'm trying to get to this aspect of making people realizing what they're actually are advocating here and what they're actually saying and what they're getting away with. Because, you know, as you rightly point out, imagine if they were talking about any other race. Let's imagine Barbara Spector when she tweets her hashtag end white people. Imagine there was a politician or some kind of NGO or lobbyist or something in Sweden or any other European country, basically, that was getting taxpayer money, sitting there tweeting end black people, you know, or end Jewish people, you know. There would be, I mean, there would be a blitz and just just a tremendous storm around this person until they were pushed out and literally tarred and feathered, you know. But nothing is happening here. What do you think will it take for white people to develop this kind of you know, racial awareness of the fact that they're being targeted, and for them to stand up for themselves and say, you know what, this is enough.
I think it's a matter of critical mass. I think it's not complicated. You know, you point out these examples to people, you show them the Gregor Gysis and the Barbara Spectors, and they get it immediately. They don't have to really have it spelled out by a racially conscious person, what's going on, the trick that's going on here. They see it immediately. All you have to do is substitute Sweden for Israel or swap them, and you can see the double standard, right? That's part of our flaw, is that we try to see it objectively, and we see it as a double standard rather than just seeing it as extreme loyalty to their own tribe, that's what the Jews are really doing. We see it as a double standard, and that's how we process it. We have to come to the conclusion ourselves, will ourselves, to have as extreme a favoritism for our own kind as the Jews do if we want to combat them, and not be so willing to be open-minded and see it as a mere conflict of interest. You know, I often have arguments with people, close friends and family usually, where I'm trying to point out the Jewish role in all of this to what's going on to them. And they see the symptoms of it. They just don't really get the cause, or they're not willing to face the cause. And I'll present them with one fact after another, one name after another, one historic detail after another. And then, you know, they'll go from saying, oh, you're crazy, it's not the Jews, you're just imagining things, you're obsessed, to by the end of the conversation, by the end of the argument, it's, oh, yeah, it's the Jews, but you're just jealous. You should be trying to do what they're doing. You should be trying to organize racially like they are, and they're just beating you at it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and which is a disconnect mentally. It's how do you go from denying that it even exists to, haha, it exists and you're losing. And you see this is a recurring pattern too with the Jews, where they'll in the open, Tim Wise is a good example of this, where, you know, he makes a living as a anti-racist and attacking white people, and he speaks publicly at universities, gets paid to do it, makes a living at it. When you have a interaction with him privately via email, he reveals that he understands what he's doing and he understands the dirty tricks. Barbara Spector, to a certain extent, I think it's a similar case. You know, behind the facade, you can see that she sort of bares her fangs where she's not out in public on a TV camera. And that's partly where the internet is helping us, is in being able to catch these incidents and publicize them to more people than would have seen them in the past. In the past, there were things that were known and people tried to publicize, but because the Jews controlled the major publishing media and that's all there was, there was a limit to how far, what your reach could be, how many people could understand this information. With the internet, anybody who wants to know can find it. And our job as people who are trying to lead people to the truth is to present it in the best form that we can, to make the most logical arguments we can, and to try and avoid sensationalism or exaggeration, because that's one of the ways that in this open, now open information environment that we have with the internet, that one of the ways that the Jews are trying to still prevail is by polluting our information, by sowing it with disinformation, misinformation, by deliberately putting people out there who are, you know, trying to get alternate explanations, and a lot of the truther movement and a lot of the these crisis actor type people are really just trying to sow nonsense in with some of the facts. They may even mention the Jews, but only in order to excuse them and say, you know, the Jews are really pawns of the Illuminati, or, you know, some other more powerful group, the aliens, the lizard people that really run things.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of this kind of stuff. In fact, you know, I see a broad spectrum of people telling stories, narratives. There's the official Jewish narrative that even President Obama and Joe Biden and other public political leaders will spout. But in the broad spectrum of the media and in the wild west of the internet, you can find things that range from it has nothing whatsoever to do with the Jews, and you can read whole books about communism and the Bolshevik Revolution that don't even mention the Jews, which is ridiculous because the Jews were at the very heart of it. To the other side of it, which is, you know, Jewish books where everything is all about the Jews. If, you know, the accusation against anti-Semites is you're obsessed with the Jews, well, all you have to do is read a book that the Jews have written. And as far as they're concerned, everything is about the Jews. There was something on your site recently that you had reprinted from a J Post article about Jaws, Jaws is really about the Jews.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I was halfway through it before I figured out that it was a Jew that was writing this. I mean, there was just too many details there of a very specific Jewish psychology that most white people just don't understand. And I realized at that point, and I skipped to the end and said, oh yeah, this is from the J Post. This is a Jew writing this. If anybody else had written that, you could imagine the howls of, oh, this is a canard that the Jews control Hollywood and the Jews.
Yeah.
But you see this kind of subtext. It's not an imagined subtext of what's, some of it maybe gets a little bit carried away, I think, in seeing the Jews behind Jaws. But there are those kind of things. In Downton Abbey, which is a very popular period piece from the BBC, there's this theme throughout the whole thing about the transition, the progress of society away from the evil Anglo-Saxon way of doing things toward what isn't really explicitly identified as Jewish, but is the Jewish way of doing things, the tolerance of homosexuality, the free love, and even the race mixing. And over the arc of the whole series, you can see this transition from a white society governed by white sensibilities to a Jewish society. At one point, the old Jewish mother of the lady of the house has some personal conflict with the man of the house's, the dowager countess. And these two old ladies, the one representing the white tradition that's on its way out, and the other representing the Jews and the up-and-coming power, she actually spells it out pretty clearly. You know, your time is going and my time is coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this subtext, this kind of subtext is, Kevin McDonald's had many articles about this kind of thing in Jewish media. And that's the thing is, the Jews are the ones producing this. I don't know what Jews exactly are behind Downton Abbey, but I'm sure that they're there. The story is a fictionalized version of a real family, apparently, that has Jews in the woodpile. So it's
interesting. It's definitely a kind of a sub, as you say, a subtextual, another layer of communication going on within it. And it's very clever, you know, some of the programming and the subtle nuances which they signal to everyone who watches this that, you know, your time is over. You know, I mean, the mind, as we know, is a powerful tool. It absorbs everything. It interprets things. It can even read things upside down and backwards and diagonally. And all of these things do, you know, kind of seep into people as well. And one thing I wanted to bring up about Jaws, which I did find interesting because I did look into it quite a bit before I posted that article. I just, you know, looking into some of Spielberg's movies and just wonder, like, wait a minute, how did he show up on the scene, what actually happened? And that was obviously it was his first big success, you know. Mm. And he took the novel by Peter Benchley, who wrote it a few years earlier, and basically completely rewrote everything. There was a number of screenwriters involved in rewriting things. I think probably four or five, and I think three of those were Jewish. And Spielberg projected a lot of things of what he thought himself was onto one of the characters in the movie, for example. So a lot of subtleties like that. But it's quite extraordinary to think about the marketing campaigns that came with Jaws as well, because it was actually by that with that movie that the whole concept of these blockbuster movies, as they call it, and even that is interesting, because a blockbuster goes back to a term of blowing up bombs that could blow up entire blocks. These are warfare terminology that they're using here, you know. Mm-hmm. So every time they're dropping these movies and a blockbuster try to program people basically in this capacity, we have to see it as it's warfare, and we have to start pointing this out to be able to make people see that, you know, these are weapons being used against us. Now, I think the most effective thing we can do is simply by pointing that out initially, at least, because then their whole machine with billions of dollars behind it will ultimately turn on themselves. It's like doing jujitsu on them or something, if you see what I'm saying.
Yes, and it's mimetic warfare. It's psychological warfare being waged against us, and language is an important part of that. And so it is very valuable to try and understand the real meanings of words and assert, if when necessary, use new words. Try and assert the old meanings of words. Nation is a good example where the older meaning of that word is related. The roots of it are related to natal. Base the womb. A nation is a group of people who are biologically related to each other, and it has been distorted to the point now where it's used as a synonym for country. It's that the people don't necessarily have any sort of biological relationship, and that's how most people understand the word now. That's how twisted it has been.
Yeah. Well, they are storytellers, as you said before, and I think this is really where we have lost the battle too. That we don't tell our own stories anymore. We haven't picked up on this. There are things that slip through the radar now and then, of course, even in Hollywood productions, although they're skewing it and changing certain things, but they still it's still indicative of the power of European stories within some of these movies. Lord of the Rings, of course, being one, but there are others as well. But I think that's really what it's about. Taking a step in the right direction of trying to encourage our own culture once more, and trying to lift these stories out and tell the stories of who we are, and creating that pride, if you will, in that again, because it's been so attacked and so destroyed. And I think many other things will kind of fall into place accordingly after that, if we simply do what we need to do to awaken our people. I think with an understanding of an appreciation of our own history, of the trials that our ancestors have gone through, all the things they had to do to win and take, protect them, take hold of their lands, all these issues that we've been fighting with. I think with that, a kind of a protective instinct is going to start to kick in when we realize that, wait a minute, all of these things that I appreciate about our people is going to be lost if we continue on the path that we're on now.
Yeah, the question is whether we can awaken fast enough to actually do anything about it. The analogy I think of is rape, and that we're waking up to a rape in progress, those of us who do wake up, and that we're faced with a choice. And it's a very brutal choice, a stark choice between either cooperating and hoping that we can survive the ordeal, or fighting trying to gouge out our attacker's eyes. And you can switch him in the middle. You can change your mind which one you're going to do. It's a little harder to go from scratching eyes to trying to cooperate. But and it's also ultimately, if you try to cooperate, and you get pregnant by your rapist, that's the end, really. At least from a racial point of view, making an analogy to our collective, to what's going on collectively here to Europe. That's the choice that we face, is to fight or to try and go along with it. And actually, for the last several decades, it's been go along with it. And it has not worked out well.
No.
For Europeans.
No, exactly. Well, I remember an article few years ago now. I think it's, or maybe it's just 1 year ago. Those Science Nordic was behind one of the versions that was released of this new find about Scandinavians being the earliest Europeans. And it was quite interesting too, because, you know, it shows that, you know, at least in my view, then things are kind of upside down in that way. But I thought about the fact that Scandinavia has been so targeted that it has, well, Northern and Western Europe in particular, of course, but that's kind of really the same stock of people. But, you know, Sweden, for example, is being absolutely flooded like no other country. I mean, we're taking in more immigrants per capita by any of the other countries combined. I'm wondering if this is like an effort to put a nail in the coffin, racially speaking, against the source of where the Scandinavians have been pouring out from. Because basically, if the white people, as they distinctly look, is terminated, that's not something that ever is going to come back. It's going to be the end of that diversity of blonde and light-eyed people, basically.
Yes, that's what Madison Grant was worried about, really, when he wrote The Passing of the Great Race. He was talking about the sub-race of Europeans called the Nordics, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Viking peoples. And you mentioned earlier the narratives of our own. And, you know, we have these Nordic sagas. We have Beowulf and other, you know, Ricardo Duchesne, who you've had as a guest, I think.
Yes.
Specializes in this kind of thing. He's one of the few people who even talks about the Aryans as Aryans, and talks about this noble, talks about their mental traits and this heroic narrative and storytelling and the ideal being of a warrior who will fight and aristocracy and that European aristocracy, you could see, which lasted up until just recently. Before it was finally snuffed out, I think it's gone now. But I think that was the remnants of the Nordic invasions that happened 5,000 years ago or so into Europe. And that from what I've come to understand about it, reading mainly, I think, of Who We Are, which is a document put together by William Pierce, that the northern parts of Europe were the most sparsely populated with hunter-gatherer peoples, and that when the Aryan invasions came, they swept over all of Europe and most completely replaced the hunter-gatherers in the places where they were most sparse in the north. And that the modern-day Scandinavians are, and I know this is a little bit at odds with what Kevin McDonald thinks about it, that he thinks it's mostly, you know, hunter-gatherers now that are reasserting themselves in the north, and that's what is the what we're seeing with the Swedish mentality and pathological altruism and all that. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't add up with my reading of it. I'd like to reconcile this to try and understand, are the people in Sweden, the Nordic peoples, mostly hunter-gatherer type background people and with hunter-gatherer psychology reasserting itself, or are they the ancestors or the descendants of the Aryans mostly?
Right.
I'd like to know. Personally, I think it's the Aryans, and that is why there is such a racial animus between Jews and whites, but especially for the Nords. They hate the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordic peoples like no other. That, you know, the Nazis, the National Socialists in Germany really put their finger on it when they saw the contrast between the scheming, rotten, dirty, ugly Jew and the Nordic ideal, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed. There is something really deep and psychological, the racial animus there between those two separate peoples. It even creates problems amongst whites that the Jews have been able to exploit this Nordicism, you know, this idealization of the Nordic peoples, that other people are envious. They, you know, they recognize the beauty of the Nordic woman. They recognize the nobility of the Nordic man. And that causes divisions even amongst Europeans, where the swarthier, darker Southern and Eastern Europeans are kind of envious of that. Maybe not Eastern Europeans so much as Southern Europeans.
There's a lot of blondes there too. I mean, in some cases now, there's more in Latvia and Estonia, I think, than in Sweden. You know,
so. That's because of ancient Viking, though. That's the Vikings went to Viking and left behind some genetic traces of that everywhere they went. Into Russia as well, amongst the Eastern Europeans there, and
Certainly, the Varangians, you know, the trade routes down all the way, the Volga and stuff like that. So, yeah, you're right. And another just interesting tidbit to this is we had another lady with us a while back as well. She was talking about how, you know, the IVF industry and a lot of these things, and actually how a lot of, you know, eggs and and sperm of you know, Aryans are actually going to Israel. I was very surprised. But it was almost like there is a, you know, they're trying to become the new Aryan or something like that. I mean, you know, there wasn't direct evidence for that, but when you begin to piece together the circumstantial evidence, that's almost what it points to. It's just weird, you know?
Yeah, well, when given a choice, people, I've read that articles like that as well, that when choosing, women want to have blonde-haired, blue-eyed, high IQ babies. And you can see it even when they're not choosing babies, but just choosing their hair color. They will go and dye their hair. They'll go and get nose jobs. They want to look more Aryan. And
well, that's just because of racism in the media, of just beauty ideals, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
Yeah, it's because of the Nazis who run Hollywood.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's actually really what they say. But it's like, it's a point just kind of hammering away at. But this aspect that there's so many people now within European countries that are sitting there absolutely angered by the fact that we have our own people on the television, and we want to, you know, we identify with our own people. We want to watch our own people. That's what we, you know, connect with. That somehow is a problem. I mean, we're so deep into the insanity and the illusion, the bubble that we created here, or having created for us, that it's difficult. I mean, you can't really even communicate these people. There's a disconnect here of explaining the things that we've been talking about here, and the idea of just having basic fundamental ethnic interests for ourselves in the same way as every other people and race or group or whatever have.
Yeah, you're talking about white privilege and what's being taught in the universities about having white people on the television and being the norm for a society is white privilege. It's just something that comes naturally in any society, that a people that and the culture that they create is sort of a natural extension of themselves. But it's pathologized in whites. It's a sign that we're doing something rotten and evil, is how it's being taught in the universities. But that's because it's our enemies doing that teaching. They see, you know, anything we do, even things that just come instinctively to us, is rotten and evil for that reason, because they see us as enemies. And we don't realize, for the most part, most white people are unconscious of this, and instead they hear this lecture and they internalize it, and they say they see some truth to it, because there is truth to it. There is this implicit unconscious racism, racial consciousness that people have, and a tendency to want to be around their own and to like their own and not like something that looks different. But they come to the wrong conclusion of that. They see that evidence, and then they accept the explanation that's provided, the poisonous enemy explanation of it that's being taught in the universities, because it's coming from very smart people who have a way with words, who can explain it. But, you know, the fact is their narrative is ensconced in universities. It's broadcast in the corporate media. It is not attacked in any way, not illegalized in any way. Whereas what you and I are talking about, we'd probably be arrested in a European country, and it's not broadcast in corporations. And it's illegalized. So,
well, you know, it's white supremacy when we do it, when we are in a position of influence and running things in our own countries, in our own societies. But when they do it, such as being overrepresented in running movie production companies or you know, the media or whatever else, then it's talent. That's just what it is, right?
And it's just what they have to do. It's what comes naturally, and it's what they have to do to preserve themselves as a people. Yeah, the lengths that people can go to in the doublethink and, you know, in order to avoid the pain, I think is what really incentivizes this. There's either the financial aspect of it, that they don't want to be fired from their job from acknowledging the double standard or the difference here, the disconnect. Or it's the psychic pain that they are married to someone who's Jewish, or they have friends who are Jews, or they have in-laws or whatever, that they don't want to say something nasty about or negative about the Jews because they know they'll get an earful from whoever about it. to physical pain. I mean, they realize once a month or once every couple of weeks, there's some sort of thing in the media that's highly publicized, some sort of public torturing that goes on, excoriation of some public figure, no matter how powerful they may be, they are basically put on the rack and tortured for their mild negative statement about the Jews. The Ann Coulter thing is the most recent example of that.
Wanted to ask you about that. Where will that go? What do you think this will mean for her?
Well, there's a lot to say about it, but just in line with what I was just saying, it's an example. There's a French expression about making an example of one admiral in order to send a message to all the others. I forget what the actual French term is, but you know, this is how the fear is propagated. You take somebody who's powerful, and in today's headlines, it's Ann Coulter. A few months ago, it was actor who said something, the Planet of the Apes actor who said something about the Jews controlling Hollywood in the context of saying something negative about how our society is falling apart. Then he talked about how the Jews run Hollywood. And basically, if you connect the dots, it's the Jews who are causing this. That's why it caused such an uproar. Gary Oldman. Before Gary Oldman, you had
Mel Gibson.
Before that, there was the Galliano, the designer in France, who
Marlon
said something
Brando,
negative about
even
Jews.
Way back, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so it's this regular occurrence. Tom Perkins is another, a very wealthy man in the United States, who said basically that he thought the 1% stuff, the Occupy Wall Street, could lead to a sort of some sort of Kristallnacht against the 1%. And and before that, it was, and the Jews jumped on him for using the word Kristallnacht. By the way, the Marine Le Pen story is a similar thing, where Marine Le Pen compared the Muslims. She said that the Muslims, and this was in 2010, they're bringing it up again now, persecuting her for what she said back then. It had to do with her seeing all of these Muslims in the streets. It's obvious that France is under Muslim occupation or heading in that direction. And she said, well, you know, people like to talk about the German occupation or the Nazi occupation. This is an open occupation as well. And the reason she was, she's being persecuted for that, for racial incitement to racial hatred or something, is even though she sort of is nodding to the Jewish narrative about how the Nazi occupation, that the Nazis were evil and all of that, she is making that comparison. And the way the Jews would describe that as diminishing the memory of the Jews in the Holocaust or something, somehow taking,
and
it is, in a way, it's basically using their own weapon for your own people's defense.
Yeah.
Say, okay, the Holocaust was bad. I want to prevent a Holocaust against my own people. No, then the Jews get upset that you're using their proprietary weaponized tool. And it was a similar thing with Sarah Palin a couple of years ago during the last election cycle. She said something, she was being accused of her rhetoric causing Jared Loughner in Arizona to shoot some half-Jewish congresswoman. And she defended herself by saying that the media was accusing her of a blood libel. And the Jews went berserk in the media that she had the audacity, this Christian woman, to use the phrase blood libel. Don't you know what pain that causes to Jews? And it was like the Holocaust. The pain, supposedly, that Jews feel is in somebody using one of their own weapons for their own benefit and not for the benefit of the Jews. This is a recurring theme. So Ann Coulter did that in a way. She was talking about, she was pointing to how it was obvious to me. I sat in my own living room and watched the same thing that she was watching, that debate, and saw Israel, Israel, Israel. And I was like pointing to my family members sitting around me. See, I told you it's the Jews. And, you know, even the most powerful people running for the most powerful position in the world, certainly in America, are talking as if, you know, they worship the Jews and Ann Coulter. About what she had to say about it is, first of all, what she said, this business about, you know, how many effing Jews are there, is right off the bat she told a fib, in that she is pointing to the lie as to numbers, that the Jewish power springs from their numbers. It doesn't. It springs from their influence, from their wealth, and from their ability to act as a group. And right after she said that, she immediately felt the power of that kind of tribal loyalty, when Jews just immediately, they didn't have to coordinate, you know, okay, what are we going to do about culture. They just immediately, as individuals and thinking of themselves as Jews, as part of this collective, came to its defense to accuse her. Yeah. They basically read into her simple statement, her criticism of the politicians and her immediate backpedaling. They read in the ancient canard of Jewish power and secretive, you know, manipulation of politics. She never said any of
exactly.
that stuff.
Yeah.
And she's not really on our side. She's on her own side. She's selling books. And that's all she was trying to do, was inject herself into that very popular debate and try to ride its coattails to get herself some more book sales. And she's has a pattern of doing that stuff. White people, I understand why white people are attracted to that kind of thing. Even people who are kind of on the borderline of racial awareness and Jew awareness like Ann Coulter instinctively, just like they like Trump instinctively, because he says the kind of tough things that need to be said. But what they are not aware of in most cases, I think, is that this has a long history, this kind of disingenuous dog whistling and selling out their own kind is a pattern that we've seen since World War II and probably earlier. The aristocracy, going back into history, has repeatedly sided with Jews, teamed up with Jews to exploit their own lower classes. And in this case with Coulter, it's pretty much the same thing going on. She's tried to defend herself by saying that, oh, no, she likes Jews and she's pro-Israel, and that's not even a question. She thinks that the people who are coming out as white nationalists or racialists in support of her are just liberals pretending to do that, just like a conservative, by the way.
Right.
This is the same way that the conservatives responded to being accused of being conservatives, because they see with blinders only left and right. They imagined that the criticism was coming from their deadly opponents, the left. And Coulter is smarter than that. In fact, all of these conservatives saying that are smarter than that too. They just know that they have to keep these blinders on and pretend like it's all about left and right, because if they take the blinders off and they start seeing in terms of Jews and whites or race in general, that they will be destroyed, they'll be removed from the mainstream, they'll no longer be able to sell their books, they'll no longer be able to sell their services to the Republican Party. So it's fear that enables this to go on. It's fear and self-interest.
Yeah, I mean, it's the bottom line here, I think, is that, you know, all these different, you know, movements that we see and all these different, you know, angles and political things and whatever that's happening right now, none of that is going to be, it isn't strong enough to oppose what is happening and the severity of the situation. You know, these conservatives running around trying to, you know, ape after the Democrats and pushing the same policies just a couple of years late, you know. That's not going to do anything. And I think that more and more people are going to realize how deep in the doo-doo we are, especially in Europe now, as things are going to get more and more violent there. I wish it wasn't so, but it's evident by the footage that I've seen so far with all these riots and the ungratefulness and the way that the incoming people are, like, you know, throwing away water bottles, booing at the border patrol that's there to help them and, you know, give them food and these things. And some of these, you know, regular riots that we've started to see from Paris to Germany to Stockholm of utter chaos, of torching cars and running through the streets. And I mean, there is a civil war unfolding right now in Europe. It hasn't really heated up to the level where it's going to be, but I think that's in the future going to be a regular occurrence. And I think the most, you know, backward people that never have thought about these things are, I think, hopefully finally going to realize that, like, oh shit, is this what it meant all along? Is this what I advocated? And I, to a certain extent, I don't want that to happen, but I want them to have that experience and that rude awakening of just like saying, you know, just to point out, you stupid idiot, like, what were you thinking this was going to lead to? You know what I mean?
Yes. And I hope that they'll be benched by the realization that they'll stop the poisonous activities that they've been carrying out and stop talking so wonderfully about these immigrants and these refugees and start realizing that they're invaders, and that even if they don't join us, that at the very least they'll sit it out and stop helping the enemy, stop helping the other side. I think the most hope is in Europe as opposed to America, mm-hmm. unfortunately, because in Europe, the independence of every state is far greater than in the United States. We have this federal system we went through a similar struggle, power struggle in the 1950s and 60s with the civil rights, where some states had the local people had more of an awareness of that this was going to go off a cliff, and they didn't want to go off a cliff, so they stood up. There was massive resistance to try and fight back, and still they were overcome by the federal level. In Europe, it's the EU that serves as this federal authority that tries to impose this stuff on all the countries, whether they want it or not. But at least there is more independence there, and it's a more recent thing. You know, with the blacks in the South and in the United States, they had been there for hundreds of years. In Europe, this is even though the some of the immigrants have been there now for decades, this huge impulse of aliens being dropped into the middle of Europe so quickly can't do anything but create violence and a violent reaction to it. What I hope doesn't happen, what I think the elite is going to try and get out of this is actually war. And they're going to try to have white military fighting white military in Europe in order to basically seal the deal. You know, that they've imported this massive number of aliens. That's how it's going to be resolved, with a terrible conflict. And that if they have their way and that conflict is fought between white militaries that then end up killing each other, the narrative afterward is going to be, you see what kind of pain and suffering is created by racism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Evil, that's the narrative of World War II, right? The evil nationalists, the evil racists who wanted to try and run the world had to be put down like mad dogs, and look at the destruction it created. That is totally false. It's actually the Jews who instigated that war and who are responsible for the terrible destruction, or at the very least, you know, that the destruction is to blame on lots of people. But it's very, you notice how the Jews get actually zero of the blame, at least in the official telling of that story. And it'll be the same thing with Europe. If we don't rise to this challenge and actually prevail, you can see how history in the future will paint this as, you know, despite the fact that our defense of ourselves was weak and eventually overcome, it will be remembered by the non-white historians writing history in the future as just more evidence of our innate evilness and why we had to be defeated and scrubbed from our ancestral homelands, and why it was right to do it. And I don't want that to happen. I don't want that to come to pass.
Of course not. But in all sincerity too, if we don't rise to that occasion, if we don't accept that challenge and make sure that we do whatever we need to do to remain who we are, then maybe we're not as great as we think, right? I mean, there has to be a recognition that we have a past which is very, very, we're a proud people. We've developed a lot of things. We have done a lot of great things for all the world, from technology and to bringing even the very human rights that all these people are using against us in our own countries now, or something that we brought to them, you know?
Yeah, but that's nothing to be proud of. The military aspect is also nothing to be proud of, but it is definitely, military prowess is a European thing, military technology, military strategy. And that's the thing that we do better than any other people on this planet. The problem that we have is that our targeting system, our control, what do they call it, command and control, is not in our hands. And the morals in our minds are not even aligned with our own interests. It's we see the interests of the alien as, not when I say we, I mean collectively speaking, there are plenty of us who don't have the wrong ideas in our heads, who have gotten our heads straight about it. But the bulk of our people don't even see it properly.
No,
they see them as refugees, as poor, as suffering, as needing compassion, and try to give it to a certain extent. Most of it, I think, is just lip service to make themselves look good and feel good, and to escape punishment for trying to buck it. But the reality is we need to get straight in our heads first, that it's okay to be on our own side, that we have a side to be on, and that at the very least in Europe, with this war that they're going to try to create to put an end to us once and for all, that at the very least we can refuse to participate in it, that we can go AWOL, that we can fire at our officers that are giving the commands, that we can, you know, we don't have to pull the trigger against other Europeans. And that hopefully, ultimately, if we can show that kind of backbone, then we can maybe start to seize back control of our command and control and our own militaries and use them to set things right again.
Well, that's just it. It's a very delicate, dangerous time right now, too. I mean, what if Hungary enters into some kind of opposition prematurely, for example, that the rest of Europe, NATO, America, everybody would turn against them. They would destroy them utterly, you know?
Yes, but the same thing in Greece and in the Balkans is when it happened last and when military force was actually used against Serbia. Because Wesley Clark said that there is no room in Europe any longer in the 21st century for ethnically pure states. That's a 19th century concept. That is the Jewish narrative. That is the standard mainstream narrative about what is necessary for Europe. And this is in direct contrast to Israel as a Jewish state, which is also part of the Jewish narrative and is mouthed by all of the Western leaders that the Jews have a right to maintain exactly what we're told Europeans don't.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's also kind of why America also has a very vital and important role in this. Americans, too. I mean, of just trying to gain control, take back control from the people who occupy your government and have taken it over and are running it now, because it's the most powerful military in the world. It will be used. I mean, look at what they did in Serbia. I mean, it could just basically be a larger version of that that's going to happen in Europe.
Right. So back to Trump, then, suppose Trump becomes president, and I think it's very likely he will. He has
really,
he is the strongest. He has the most appeal. You know, the media describes that as populism and as if it's a bad thing, but it is what a democratic society or a democratic system is supposed to do. You know, the most popular candidate is supposed to win. That isn't how it really works, but it does seem like he's going to be able, he has popular support, and eventually the Jews will probably, the moguls and the finance and media moguls will eventually call him into a meeting and say, look, you're going to be president and this is what is going to happen. This is what you're going to do. This is what you're going to say. This is what you're not going to do and not going to say. And he's going to be compelled to either accept that or not, but he won't become president if he doesn't accept it. And I think out of President Trump, what we are going to see is that the borders won't be closed. I've already made that prediction. And because that's happened historically with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger and other, there's probably other politicians in Europe who have also made similar promises and then reneged on those promises once they got into power. And I think what we're going to more likely to see is war, because every time there's a Republican in office in the United States these days, it seems like that's when the Jewish neocons, that half of Jewish political power, gets the reins, and they're more concerned with waging war overseas. The liberal, the leftist Jewish side is more concerned with waging war at home, social, domestic war on the whites at home. The right-wing Jews are more concerned with waging war against the brown people, their enemies, their Muslim enemies elsewhere in the world. And so they'll send our troops into Iraq, as they did under Bush. And I suspect Trump would be tricked or manipulated or convinced to go to war against Syria and or Iran. The Jews have been beating the drums of war for war against both of those countries for years now. It's a measure of the fact that they don't have total control, that they haven't been able to get those wars, but they have been pushing for them, and they will eventually get them. And I think it's more likely that they'll get them under a Trump than they would under, say, Bernie Sanders, who is a Jew, who everybody knows is a Jew. And so Bernie Sanders, his focus will be domestically and in opening the borders and giving legal citizenship to all of the aliens.
That would he would be a good candidate for, like, really bringing in the American Bolshevik Revolution and starting gulags and stuff, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's just, the American Bolshevik. There's nothing like it. You know, it's funny because Eastern Europeans would laugh in the face of most Americans who are ideologically, drawn to the kind of communism that they are today. It's a little bit reformed. There's a little bit differences there, but it's like, they really don't haven't experienced that and what that was, and it feels like that's really in the rise, on the rise in America as well, that there's this whole, kind of class there of people that would be very happy to to turn, not of course on the true 1%, as you mentioned, but on the middle class and maybe those a little bit above that, and steal all their wealth and put them in the camps, you know?
Yeah, most Americans think that communism was defeated. And in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was elected, you know, the next thing that happens was communism collapsed. And but they don't realize that it really just morphed. And racialists mostly understand that Marxism morphed into cultural Marxism, right? And most of them understand that it has to do with the Jews. And that's the other thing about communism is most people, even if they know a bit about communism, don't understand the Jewish role in communism and the fact that it morphed and didn't go away because the Jews didn't go away. The Jews won World War II. They got their side won and the white race lost. And that's really what's going on. And even the Cold War between the United States and Russia really hasn't gone away. This latest flare-up in Ukraine has called attention to that the Jewish media is very anti-Russian, trying to stir up some kind of war between the United States and Russia. You know, beyond Syria and Iran, which they would be able, or Israel would directly benefit from us invading and defeating either one of those countries. The war with Russia seems it's more distant from Israel, but it's more closely in tune with, I guess, their globalist agenda Russia, to a certain extent, challenges their global hegemony over money and economy.
All right. Well, Tan Stoffel, I mean, this has been a very sobering and, enlightening and also to a certain extent painful discussions about the problems that I wish we wouldn't have to focus so much time and effort on, but we do. It's necessary. And of course, if we don't even talk about these things, absolutely nothing is going to happen, and we're never going to see what the root of these issues are and how to take care of them. So it's been great having you here. Thank you so much for your time. I guess we could probably go on for another 2 hours, but we can wrap up for this time here. So please let us know if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with, if you have any words of encouragement and anything else.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You touched on something that's correct. We have to talk, even if that's all we do, as weak as that is, we have to talk in order to plan intelligently. And we have to plan and be intelligent about it in order to win. We won't be able to win if we can't plan, and we can't plan if we can't talk. So, and when we talk, we have to be as frank as we can be, even if it hurts our feelings or hurts the feelings of the people around us. We have to do it. And that's the challenge before us. That's what we have to rise to face at the very least. And then, beyond that, there's going to be some even tougher things that need to be done.
All right. Let's give out the website once more. Tell us what's on there. I know, as you said, I know you don't write regularly, obviously, too much anymore. I wish you would, though, obviously. Your writing is very good, and we need more people like yourselves being out there and touching on the stories, that unfolds every day. I've noticed that there's a lot of good examples that can be made, but with everything that's happening and tying it to current events, because so many people have such short attention spans,
Right. At my site, I provide both articles, in-depth articles with lots of details, and podcasts where I talk about pretty much the same topics. And I don't intend to stop. It's just that I acknowledged recently, after being silent for a long time, that it's going to be irregular from here. For the last several years, especially when I was working at the White Network, I was very methodical about having a regular output every week, a podcast, and pretty much every week some sort of a blog post. And I'm not keeping that up. And so I don't want people to wonder, what happened? Did Mossad get him, or did he lose faith, or whatever? It's just, I'm not doing that now, but it's not, I'm not saying that I'm going to stop. I'm going to keep it up. I have more to say. I have more things that I'm interested in delving into, and will at some point.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking about these things and writing about them. Really appreciate it. age-of-treason.com is the website. We'll have that linked up on redicecreations.com, of course. Thank you so much again. Hope we can do it again in the future.
I agree. Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, friends, members, ladies, and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. We also hope you learned something new. We'll be back in just about a day or so. And then, of course, next week, we have another 314 with Lana coming up as well. Well, thank you for your continued support of what we do. In the meantime, we say have a great rest of your day or evening, wherever you are, and keep growing stronger and dare to look reality in the eye. We will talk more soon.